Matt Segundo here, and while it's been some years since I set foot in New York City, I can certainly attest that if writers like Brian Francis Slattery are offering strange sentences in their books, it must certainly remain a strange town still. Anyway, I don't know who this Brian guy is, but if he wishes to refer to himself in three names as if to claim himself more important and morally superior to the other Brian Slatteries inhabiting our thankless universe, then I'm guessing he's one of those pretentious twits who lives in Fifth Avenue, or on it, or under it, or somewhere around it. I must object to this interview on principle, if only because two names are better than three.
Okay, so I am here with Brian Francis Slattery, the author of Spaceman Blues. Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. First off, I wanted to actually ask you a question about this book. Well, I mean, I have several questions, obviously, about this book, but specifically, Matt Cheney made a very interesting observation. He observed that reading this book requires sort of a leap of faith on the part of the reader, in the sense that the style is just really remarkably rich, and the vigor just so ebullient that you kind of read this wondering, well, how's this guy going to continue to sustain this? So what steps did you take, starting off of a general question, to kind of maintain this vigor throughout the course of 200 pages?
That's an interesting question. It helped that I was actually kind of writing it quickly. I wrote it while I was in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And then I started off... it was all while I was in graduate school and during the school year when I began it. So I really just wrote it when I had spare time. And I was kind of in a hurry to get it out there.
Really?
And so it was... Or to get it out of me is more like it. So when I was... if I had an hour, I would just write as much as I could in an hour, and then that was it. Then I'd have to do something else. And then while I ended up finishing it while I was in Guatemala, and I actually think to this day that there is something about being there that lended a certain urgency to it. Uh-huh. The place where I was always felt a little bit unstable, and that I had to be careful where I went and all of that kind of thing. And I think a lot of that ended up getting into it, that sort of the vibe of sort of like we have to hurry, we have to get something done, we have to be careful, things are happening, that sort of sense of slight paranoia. Though I hesitate to say that it's paranoid, because I don't tend to like really overly paranoid books all that much. Well, some of them I do.
For the stuff you wrote in Guatemala, was that helpful for you as a writer to sort of access certain neighborhoods in New York, or did you write those scenes for Guatemala? Or?
Yeah.
Of course in Connecticut as well, but you know.
Right. But at the time I didn't live there yet. But the it was really helpful because I realized at one point that the book was going to be about the underground economy. And while I was in Guatemala, I really saw like the other side of it. The underground economy in New York is one that's, there's a lot of immigrants, but the better word is migrant, which I learned while I was there. That people really do just go back and forth all the time, and it was really amazing getting to see the other side of the immigration debate in the United States. Mm-hmm. Where you meet people who go back and forth every year. The guy who, I just remember individuals, like there's the guy who worked in a Sizzler 6 months out of the year, just cooking in the back there. And then he would save up enough to like buy a motel in Guatemala. And then there was another guy who would, he would go and just do construction jobs in LA and then come back and he would have enough to make it, to build a house. Yeah. And when I started to see there are these people who they take these jobs that here are very low paying, but then the dollar multiplies by like 7 or 8 when you get there, and you see how ingeniously they work it. It was really sophisticated, and it was much more sophisticated than I would have ever given, people credit for. And before, you realize like these are people who are kind of like they're almost like playing the currency market, which mm-hmm. is something that you only imagine sort of hedge fund managers and Wall Street people doing, but these people did it every day of their lives, and they're really smart and really, really savvy about how to sort of use the system.
Or to use sort of existing elements, too. It's sort of like the relative nature of the dollar. I mean, I just moved to New York, and people said, oh, it's so expensive. And I was like, no, not if you are careful about it, you know?
Right. And these are people who could do that with multiple currencies. You know, in their head, they would sit there going, sure. Well, this will get me this, and this will get me this. And they could see sort of all the angles immediately. And then, you know, that... I don't think that gets talked about as much as it should, you know, just how amazing they are at figuring out how to make that system work for them. You know, and these are people who are coming from such a system of position of extreme disadvantage, but then, like, you know, all they're doing is, you know, they're figuring out how to get ahead. And like I was really, really impressed and really you know, I admired them, and I was kind of in awe of how much they could do with how little they had. And a lot of that ended up in the book. And when I came back to New York, I found that I could see it. You know, when I came back, it was almost like a veil had been lifted, and suddenly I could see what they had been talking about in Guatemala, I could see here.
Sure.
You know, because they would describe what they did when they were in the United States, and then you say, oh, yeah, there they are, you know. Here they all are doing these things that, you know, that we sort of take for granted, but for them it's not, you know, it's their life.
It's interesting that you mention this, and I'll go into Dark Town in a minute, but I actually wanted to remark upon how food in this book, seriously, food actually is kind of this... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You mentioned like a Jarritos or a potato chips, and as a result, we immediately know what culture we're in. Did you find that food was related to this issue of economy, or that food was a kind of nice shorthand way for you to refer to particular cultures?
It's more the second one. You know, I'm one of those... I love food. I love to eat, and I love to eat, you know, different things. And there's actually a speech in the book that one of the Egyptian cooks gives that I was given by an actual Egyptian cook who talked about how history of Egypt is in its food. And I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. But then, you know, it's true of most places, right? That, like, if, like, the ingredients that people use, they're a product of historical circumstance. Mm-hmm. But he really sort of laid it out saying, you know, We got these spices when this... He actually described it as, you know, the series of people that would occupy and then leave Egypt. And they'd leave behind an ingredient that ended up being part of Egyptian cuisine.
Yeah.
And, yeah, to a certain extent, it's a shorthand. But then it really was a really great way to talk about, you know, more about the ways that the different immigrant groups live.
Or basically, perhaps it was a way for you to, I guess, refer to these living styles in a manner that didn't disrupt the flow of the prose. Was
right.
that kind of
right? And I would sort of hope that it wouldn't be alienating. You know, that it wouldn't, you know, that people didn't have to know exactly what a Jarritos soda is, for example, to know that, you know, in context, it's not the soda you get at your sort of regular supermarket. Sure. It's the soda you're going to get at the bodega or the soda you'll find in Mexico. And I was sort of hoping that I could get away with having that come across without necessarily having the guy go, oh, yeah, I had a Jarritos last week. You know, I hope that that's not necessary, but...
Dark Town, I mean, to me, it could be read as a sort of representative exemplar of this underground world that you were sort of describing in terms of the way of the economy, but it also suggested a kind of sort of Lovecraftian kind of underworld as well. And I was wondering, were there any sort of fictive antecedents that kind of inspired this underworld, or was it more sort of your observations and what you had studied as an economist?
The second part of it is easier to answer. For a while, I thought that I would have those scenes take place in a specific neighborhood in New York. Mm-hmm. And I spent a long time thinking about, well, what group would I want to focus on and where would I want it to be? And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized I kind of wanted to talk about the immigrant experience generally. You know, like I didn't want to have to tie it to a specific group. And in some ways I wanted to talk about the ways that the various immigrant groups, when they get here, will tend to work together.
Sure.
You know, there's such a thing as an immigrant community.
Yes.
And I wanted to be able to, like, to talk about that, you know, in a sort of cool and engaging way, and also to really get across the point that, like, that's this whole network that you don't see. Mm-hmm. You know, it exists here, but, you know, you have to know where to look in order to find it. And let me think. I mean, I'm one of those people who had at the right age, I think I had devoured a lot of science fiction and fantasy. You know? So that whole idea of like an underground world, I mean, is everywhere.
Sure.
Right? And I don't think there's a specific, you know, it's H.P. Lovecraft, it's this. I mean,
yeah.
I've always just sort of been taken with that idea, you know, that there's a, you know, there's a world existing in parallel to ours. And it, you know, I sort of figured it'd be a cool, it's, you know, it's one of those science fiction fantasy tropes that I really like. And I almost, every time I come across a story that uses it, I tend to like it, you know, from Greek mythology to like that TV show Beauty and the Beast, and when they do it. But then the other aspect of it was that there are people that live below the city anyway. I mean,
sure.
And people don't know how many of them there are. But I thought that was a nice way to kind of justify exaggerating it. You know, I wasn't just making it out of whole cloth. It was, you know, there are people that live in the subway tunnels. There are people that live in the infrastructure. And
there are a number of memoirs of people who have actually lived in the subway tunnels.
That's
that I'm actually in the process of trying to get to myself.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those sorts of topics. I also wanted to kind of remark upon what few reviewers and few people looking at this book have actually observed, and that is all the many relationship models in this book. You have Wendell going with Manuel. You have Diane and her five boyfriends. Was it as important to you to kind of present sort of these vaguely polyamorous kind of relationships along with more traditional relationship structures as a way to kind of show that New York or the world as we sort of see it is actually modeled upon a number of different types of people, as much as that New York is kind of a polarizing sort of city for this kind of thing?
Yeah. And it's also just my general, to the extent that I have an agenda when I write something, a lot of it does involve sort of, I want to talk about people that I don't feel like get talked about all that much.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that I think that's just one facet of that. You know, I want to hear more stories about, you know, about people that aren't, you know, your sort of white middle class protagonist kind of thing. You know, I figured, you know, if people aren't going to write them, I'm going to write some of them and then, you know, see what happens. I mean, there are plenty of examples out there, but I feel like there should be more.
I have a sort of rather intricate question, so I hope you can humor me. I'm actually going to read a section of the book because I think that it's important to offer the listeners here a sample of the text. This is a description of Darktown. Long calls from cooks, the constant clatter of cutlery, frantic atonal runs from a piercing, nasal reed instrument somewhere, the cries of animals being slaughtered, and now the air is thick with smoke and steam, the smells of 72 spices, vegetables, offal, blood. Now, I have to ask you about this sentence. First of all, there's a lot of things going on here. We have a number of noun phrases thrown at the reader without many verbs. So I'm interested in having you talk about that. We are also in this kind of, I guess, locative and temporal fugue state just to some degree. I mean, we start off very much in the present with this sentence, and then we end up with this qualifier now in which, oh, well, are we actually advancing in time along with the sentence? So I have to ask you, how a sentence along these lines, and there are many like this in this book, how does a rhythm like this, is it determined by this kind of locative or temporal quality? Was this what you were striving for throughout the whole of the book? Why choose nouns and noun phrases over verbs? Why this sort of emphasis on, I guess, rushing the reader into a sort of specific set of time in the sense of having that now in there? Things along those lines.
Right. I see what you mean. The using noun phrases, I guess I'm one of those people that, I'm one of those writers that always tries to say things as short as I can. You know, it's almost a tick at this point. You know, there was, like, one of my sort of private jokes in this book is that I there are only four adverbs in it. And I was really, really excited about that. I wanted to write it so there were no adverbs in it at all. Like, I hate them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written many things with no adverbs in it. And I love not doing that. And so, the sentences without verbs, it was because I could get away with it. I realized that it made sense without having a verb in it. And I loved that. And I thought, great, you know, because I really like the effect that comes from having the sentences just be like really dense and packed like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there's a great way that everything kind of rushes at you at once when you do that. I think this may be a good time to, you know, there was a, I've heard a couple of writers say this, and I'm kind of in that, or in interviews I've read them, and I'm definitely in that camp of people who, like, if I could be a really good composer, I would be writing music. Mm-hmm. But I'm not. I mean, you know, I can't really write music, and I can't, you know, I can't even really write a good 3-minute song. But so much of that, you know, that desire to write something, you know, that has a rhythm and a flow to it, you know, I do want the prose to be sort of musical. I want it to sound good, and I want it to have a beat.
Do you find that nouns as word units work better for you in terms of sustaining this kind of rhythm? Or?
Yeah. I mean, when this is getting really weird, but when I was writing the book, I was really, and to, this fascination continues to this day, but I was really starting to get into a lot of African music. Oh. And especially the sort of the polyrhythmic aspect of it, you know, where you have, you know, 4 or 5 different lines of music going at once. And each of them is very short and sort of pixelated. When you put it all together, you get this unit. And I thought, I wonder if you could write a book like that, you know. And that was a lot of what determined the style of this book, you know. So in some ways, like I was always kind of thinking about those, you know, the type of music where each individual part is, you know, like, you know, just wait, and so a lot of the sentences are constructed that way. But the I think that getting to the second part of your question, which you have to remind me of.
About the sort of locative quality of the sentence, right, about, like, right, you know, the now and going from the present,
right,
to the present, and to carry the reader along throughout the course of time.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I remembered their sentence.
Oh, no problem.
Right,
I have a tendency to throw a lot of questions
at once.
No,
it's great.
So, yeah.
I do the same thing when I interview people. It's horrible. And they go, what are you asking me? And I go, right. You need this in smaller chunks. So there's a set of writers that I idolize for their ability to sort of put you in that place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they talk about something, it's always like they want to stick you right in the middle of it. You know, they're not observing it from space. They're not, you know, they're not sort of observing it in retrospect. They're right there now. And really, I, you know, the choice of, like, writing in the present tense, for example,
sure,
is one of those, like, which is, I think, what you're really asking. I mean, most of the book is in the present tense, and
well, it's not just the present tense. I'm actually talking more about the locative quality of that sentence, about, like, you know, basically starting off with long calls from cooks, and so, okay, we're presently, yes, we're definitely in the present tense,
right,
but we're also being carried along by saying as if we're actually caught into this
good
particular environment.
I understand your question.
Yeah.
So the a lot of that came from, it's worth going back to Guatemala for this. I mean, a lot of that came from what I really wanted to get in some cases was the sort of sense of shock that you might get from being in a place that's just really different from what you've expected in a place that seems sort of slightly dangerous, and you don't know what the rules are, and you're afraid that breaking the rules is going to get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a way that those things can sort of come at you, like, it's, you know, like, this is happening. Oh, now this is happening.
Yeah.
Now this is happening. And you end up sort of very much living from second to second. You know, it's really hard to put what you're seeing in the context of your day. You know, the bus you took to get there seems like a long time ago. You know, the time when you're leaving seems like far off, and you're really just there, you know, absorbing one thing after another, or maybe feeling threatened by it or whatever it is. But I really wanted to try to get that effect, you know, that sense of, like, oh, we're in a different place now.
Yeah.
And it's confusing. And I think I had said this at one point in the notes when we were editing the book, where I was saying, look, I'm really okay with people feeling disoriented and confused, you know, at certain parts of the book. I don't want them to be confused at the end of the book, but, you know, I'm really okay with that sense of, like, you know, what's going on? Who are these people? You know, what's that over there? You know, that that was kind of an important effect that I wanted to sustain for as long as a reader could tolerate it.
Yeah, I mentioned this whole notion of set intervals of time and location simply because you also do something similar to what Edward Jones does in his fiction, and that is actually flash-forwarding or flashing back to a particular sort of character's development or history or the like. And so I'm wondering if these were sort of done to either A, disorient, or, as you say, or B, this were maybe kind of give yourself a few markers with which to play with. I don't know if you actually outlined this book, but I was very curious about how this notion of interval throughout the book actually kind of came to be.
I didn't outline anything, so
I had a feeling.
That's the easy.
Yeah.
It doesn't read like that, you know, and I'm
which is not
well
to take away from it, by the way.
No, but it's not. That's not, you know, that's just not the kind of book it is.
Sure.
But the I mean, part of it was a purely technical thing, which is that, you know, the typical thing of writing a novel in the past tense, because I knew that I wanted to move around in time a lot. And the reason for that goes back to my desire to make a story as compact as possible. Like, I find that fooling around with the time is, if I had to tell it linearly, it would be a lot longer. And I don't want to do that. I want it to be, like, short and tight. So, you know, by chopping out years here and there, you can really, like, you can really compact the story and tell the same thing in a shorter period of time.
Sure.
But the when I realized that I wanted to do that, the present tense was a good idea because otherwise you end up with like past perfect and past future and these really sort of complicated, you know, verb structures that I didn't want to use. I wanted to just be able to say, this will happen, this happened, this is happening, and not say, you know, this might have happened if blah blah, you know, and to get into all this sort of subjunctive stuff that makes sense is a lot more gnarly than I wanted them to be. You know, I wanted them to be like short and, well, they're not so short, but I wanted them to be punchy.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to use short words. I wanted to, you know, to really have the prose come at you like bam, 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 bam.
Is this kind of why you strayed away from verbs? Because dealing with verbs would actually get you into this kind of direct linearity? Or?
Right. Yeah. Right. And but it really came down to, you know, me wanting the book to read in this very sort of, you know, I wanted it to have this very sort of headlong quality, you know, that it's sort of propulsive and, you know, energetic.
I also wanted to actually ask you about the dialogue in this book. There are two things I noticed about it. The first one is probably obvious, and that is the ellipses, which reminded me very much of like playing a square game of some sort, like one of those Final Fantasy games where you hit the button and then all of a sudden dot, dot, dot.
Right.
So I had to ask you if that was a possible influence for these sorts of pauses. And then also the end dashes, which I don't think, I note only because I'm like, I'm obsessive about typographics, but it's very, very small, the end dash that you use, and it's almost unnoticeable for the flow. And so I'm wondering how these two things came about.
Okay, so the dialogue writing, there's one of my sort of favorite authors that nobody seems to read is William Gaddis.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason for that is that his dialogue is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I've never read dialogue as good as the dialogues in his book. I mean, it's astonishing.
Well, the party scene and the recognitions is, I mean, that's just fantastic.
Yeah, but his ear for the way that people talk is just, it's out of control how good it is. And when I was reading his books, I mean, I almost didn't care what they were about after a while. I mean, I was just so taken with the way that he could get his characters to talk. And he's one of those people that, you know, when I was really looking at how he put it together, you know, I realized he was paying a great deal of attention to the punctuation and the way that he could use the punctuation to get tones of voice. And, you know, the end dashes were a great way to kind of, I mean, I hope that it works. And it was definitely, I think I might have ripped it off completely from him, is the, you know, the idea that, like, someone is cutting in on somebody else.
Sure.
Or even that they have a sense, there's an urgency in the way that they start their sentence. Like, but what about this?
Yeah.
You know, and that there's a way that end dash can communicate a little bit of that. You know, that he's interrupting, even if they're not necessarily interrupting what the other person is saying. There's that, like, but wait, I want to tell you this. And he does, I don't think that he does the thing where there's just the ellipses and that's it on a line, but he got really close. There were a couple of times where he would use these ellipses where it was clear that he was using it because the speaker was waiting for somebody else to talk and they didn't.
Yeah.
And so the person continues. And I sort of thought, that's great. I love that. And And I've always sort of disliked those things in you know, things in books where the writer is forced to have the character do something just to sort of pass the time, like they rub their nose or they adjust something on their, mm-hmm. you know, they adjust their clothes or whatever it is. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I just want it to be that, like, there's a pause. And so that's really where it came about. But I'm almost positive it's something that I would have taken from William Gaddis, because I read all of them with that sense of, like, how does he do this? How does he get this thing to work?
If you liked Gaddis so much, then I'm wondering why you didn't go all the way and do away with quotes. Because, I mean, that's interesting to me that you stuck with the end dash quote, basically.
Yeah. I think it was just because I associate the quotes as being, like, an American versus European thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm an American writing in America, and, you know, we use quotes over here.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Marianne Wiggins would argue with you, though.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, plenty of people would argue with me, but I think it was that simple. I felt like, you know, it is like, you know, in French and Spanish, they don't use quotation marks. They just use the dash to show that somebody's talking. And, yeah, and Gaddis does that, too, and... But there's something really cool about that.
The question is this an authentic American book? Since so many, it is the immigrant experience as well. So I'm wondering,
right,
you know, this causes an interesting sort of question as to how one choice sort of creates a sort of foundation and perspective.
Yeah, I think at least stylistically, there's this group of American writers that I've loved since high school and continue to love to this day, and they're definitely my role models in a lot of ways. You know, I don't know that, you know, I would say, like, I'm part of a tradition or whatever it is. Like, that feels very that feels very pompous to me, you know. But
yeah.
But the, you know, they are people that I idolize, and, you know, when I think about, you know, where I would like to be, you know, I picture myself sort of writing for them to some extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're Americans, so, you know, I'm gonna try to adhere you know, American typographical conventions as much as possible.
Well, speaking of this whole notion, I actually wanted to remark upon a common motif throughout the book, and that is characters who are going to stick in their location no matter what the disaster, such as Swami and the whole scenario with the house, like,
yeah.
I'm not
going to
be
yeah.
left. Without giving away, near the end, we see a lot of that.
People who aren't leaving their houses, though it's, like, it's a little ridiculous that they don't.
And I'm wondering how much of that came upon upon the rootless nature of immigrants coming to New York, or maybe you can kind of remark upon how this became the clinging to territory like this.
One of the things that I thought was important when I was writing it is that I wanted all of the characters to refuse to be victims. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted them to, you know, faced with the situation, I wanted them to do something about it. And so when the situations in the book got increasingly grim, you know, in some ways, someone's holding their ground felt like the best way for them to respond to it. You know, that they're gonna stick this one out. I mean, even though they could leave.
Sure.
You know, and some of them do leave, but I think it was part of that is that I wanted the characters to all be, you know, people who don't spend a lot of time, you know, whining about their life being difficult. You know, I wanted them to be characters that you know, try to improve them, you know, improve their circumstances.
Sure.
So that was really, I think, more part of why I had some of them stick around. And you sort of see that too, right? I mean, there. I while I was in grad school, I remember reading a report of people living in eastern Congo, and they were, I mean, their village had been, you know, there was like a volcano exploding nearby, and their village had been, you know, ransacked by soldiers from three different armies, and then, you know, you look at them like, why do you stay? You know, this place is horrendous. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, and they had some of the hardest lives on the planet, and then you get. You know, someone will say, you know, well, you know, this is my house. You know, where am I going to go? And they don't say it out of desperation. I mean, they say it because they're like, this is where I came from, you know, and this is this thing that I have. And, you know, it's a tough situation, but, you know, damn it, this is my house. And I always really, you know, I really admired that, you know, when you see, you know, when I read it, I just thought that's really amazing. You know, like, I'm not sure that I would have the sort of fortitude to say, you know, I'm going to stick this one out because, you know, this thing is important to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought about, you know, those folks when I was thinking about some of the characters that stay.
Yeah. Would you say this is more of, I guess, a New York novel in this tradition of people gravitating to New York like a beacon? Or
That it's like in that... Wait, say that one again?
Would it be like more sort of, I guess, a New York novel in the tradition of sort of, say, something like Ragtime, where people come to New York as a sort of beacon, as a sort of place of hope? Or...
Yeah.
The thing about this book is that it's really very difficult to classify. I mean, if you were to pick one particular taxonomic classification, or is a question of taxonomy irrelevant?
It's not something that I was thinking about. I mean, it didn't seem all that important to me at the time. I think that I did want it to be the, you know, a novel about this city, and it's cool that it developed that way, because I think originally I had the idea that the plot would range farther geographically than it ended up being, and when I sort of realized that I could tell the entire story that I wanted to tell in one city, oh, that's fabulous. You know, yeah. I really really appealed to me. And yeah, definitely, as you know, I was just talking about it with my friend Jeremy. That he's gonna get a kick out of this that I'm mentioning him in this interview.
What else can you tell us about him?
But he's from England, and you know, he was just talking about how, you know, when he came here, he's like, I came to New York. I didn't come to America. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I came here because New York is here. You know, and I think a lot of people feel that way, like, both from, you know, outside of the United States and within it. You know, that you know, there is something, I mean, whether the thing is actually here or not when they get here is almost beside the point. There's definitely something that draws people here, and it's something about the way that the history and the culture of, you know, I mean, this isn't anything new, but yeah, it's definitely something to talk about, especially given that I was writing about immigrants. You know, there's a reason that so many of them come here, and it's not just the work. There's something about the place.
Would you say that this notion of coming to New York, I mean, there's the whole sort of strings and pins that Swami has on the ceiling and all that, showing the kind of strands where it connect everybody. Just as we're talking about this idea of New York, almost, I would argue, as a sort of social system. Which, is this more of a sort of systems book, would you say? To what extent was systems very much on your mind? We were talking earlier about even the sentence. One could probably take the sentence that I read to you and sort of pick all the units out, and essentially maybe it's a sort of system of units crammed together in this sort of glorious, whoa, kind of thing.
Yeah. I think it's getting back to that thing where I was telling you that slightly pretentious and weird idea that I wanted to write this sort of polyrhythmic book you know, in which the way the various strands fit together is the way that the book operates. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that scene, you know, where the guy has this social network on his ceiling and it's gigantic was one of my attempts to, like, you know, to sort of alert the reader, like, okay, so this is kind of what this book is going to be like.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be a lot of strands going on, and I'm going to follow this one, and I'm going to follow this one, and then I'm going to follow this one.
Yeah.
And, like, this is the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
You know, and that it was, you know, it was definitely from a sort of, you know, the sort of technical perspective, a way to tell the reader what was going to go down. You know, it wasn't going to go in a straight line.
Well, when I read that, the first thing I thought of was you just sort of rang the bell that basically, remember Borges. Remember the you
people
know,
that I really like.
Yeah, remember the library. This could very well be something that dwells into a sort of multiverse sort of scenario.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with that. There's a point. I worked for about 3 years at a foundation that funded social science research, and, you know, they're academics of various stripes are always, you know, trying to find, you know, not necessarily like a, you know, an overarching theory of something, but they're always trying to show that there's a system working somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I am one of those people that thinks that that's the case, like, that things that appear random usually aren't completely random. And, you know, that's definitely that, you know, you can only read so much social science before you start thinking that way. You know, that you think, well, there's there's something at work here, and it's just a question of understanding what it is.
Going back to this idea earlier of what we were discussing about, like, you avoiding verbs because of the fear of, like, having too linear a narrative, perhaps. What did you do to sort of, I guess, was it really a matter of getting the absolute precise images like a melted cassette to kind of get that visceral experience? I mean, because we're talking about systems, but we're also talking very much about literally just, you know, the prose kind of just hits the reader, or hit me at least at any rate, like some sort of, whoa, holy, you know, I felt like it was, in a weird way, I kind of felt sometimes I was like constantly eating ice cream. It was just fantastic, you know? I mean, you know, so I wonder if you feel that, I guess,
That's really what I was going for.
I'm wondering, you know, was it a matter of, I guess, did you sort of have a kind of idea of, how do I phrase this? The noun phrases that you used in terms of stylizing them. As you were writing this book, did you kind of come across a sort of, I guess, theory as to what noun phrases would, like, latch into the reader's skull, like shrapnel or something?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I was that thoughtful about it. I guess it's really that, you know, from sentence to sentence, I like books that don't get too abstract, mm-hmm. I guess is what it comes down to. I mean, especially as I, not that I'm like old or anything, but I like books that are like, that are really concrete. And I think that you can get, you know, I like trying to pull ideas out of stuff, you know, rather than just sort of saying, yeah, this is the idea. And it's this kind of, you know, lofty thing that you then tease out the details later. I kind of like working in the, you know, from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. I think there is also I had this idea that I didn't want to write one of those things that sort of says, let me tell you what's going on inside this guy's head, let me tell you what's going on, you know, inside this. I wanted it to be that. I always felt like that was a bit of an invasion of privacy. Hmm. You know, like, you know, these are characters, and if you're going to treat them with some respect, you're not going to ask them a whole bunch of personal questions the first time you meet them.
So really, it was more.
But
of,
I felt that way about inanimate objects, also. You know, you can talk about their history, and you can talk about where they're going to go, but the idea that you're going to, like, you know, crack open their skull and say, you know, this is what this person is, you know, here's their deepest fear, you know, that kind of stuff. I didn't want to do that, and I didn't even. You know, especially as the city started to emerge as more of a character, like, I didn't want to do that to New York either. You know, I wanted to say, look, you know, just the surface of this place is fascinating. Yeah. You know, the things that you see when you walk down the street are amazing things. And you don't need to, you know, you don't need to crack them open for them to be awesome.
So for you then, what I'm getting at here, and what I'm hearing is that you were going for this more Balzacian notion of how objects and how apartments reflect people's temperament. You didn't want to get into inside them. That this was more of your kind of way of showing and perhaps maybe denying judgment of these characters or at least allowing these sorts of things.
Oh. Yeah, though I've never read any Balzac, so I can't say that that's where I got it.
Well, I mean, it's throughout fiction. It's kind of in a weird way. It's almost a realism to some degree. Realism is very much in that kind of aesthetic of objects. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and there are ways of showing, like, what, you know, what the character is feeling by showing what they do or mm-hmm. just how they live. You know, the people make their choices, and yeah, what you said, I'm really pleased that came across, is that I didn't want to ever be in the position of judging any of them. Mm. You know, and even people that were, you know, you would say, you know, maybe they should be judged. Like, I didn't want to do that. You know, I wanted them to have their say. You know, I wanted them to be able to speak their piece.
Now, did certain kinds of characters, I guess, become more central to the narrative more than others? I mean, you described this sensation of wanting to get all this particular information out of your head. Was it largely a kind of creative process of just, were you kind of played with ideas or something, or what was the deal?
In all honesty, I wrote it pretty much like sentence for sentence without thinking all that much about it.
Uh-huh.
And there's a point where, you know, these you know, the characters began to multiply, and I thought, well, you know, I'll figure out what to do with them later.
Sure.
You know, and not sort of assign any particular importance to them until I know where the story is going.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, some of them, certainly like some of them were, that I assumed were going to be sort of throwaways, ended up being more important. I sort of realized, oh, you know, that guy is going to be good for this, yeah. You know, or that woman there, I can do something with them that's going to tie this all together. But it was sort of a way of, I figured at the very least, you know, they would be, some of the characters would be a great way of just showing what the environment is like. And, you know, if I use them for something later, that would be great. I didn't realize it until later, you know, that it would be even cooler to try to use as many of them as possible, you know. Or that even that it was worth kind of getting into the, you know, the past and future of some of the minor characters to talk about some aspect of the book. You know, and they ended up being, you know, there are some characters that don't really do a lot, but I felt like, I mean, a good example is like there's the cockfighting scene where these two guys that don't, you know, you never see them again. You know, they're just these two guys that own cocks and they take care of the cocks after the fight. And there's a way that I feel like that passage is like part of like the heart and soul of the book. And it's like, you never see those people again, but I would never, like, that would be a passage that I would have fought tooth and nail to leave it in, you know, for as long as I could. And it was partially because I thought it got at something very directly that I wanted the book to say.
Not only that, but that's also our first kind of introduction into the underworld of New York, which I found, I mean, they literally go underneath and hide from the police. And that,
right.
You know?
Right.
Why the cockfighting to sort of, I guess, did you need this kind of really violent bout to kind of at least, did you feel that this was the right kind of key to unlock this door?
Yeah, I think it was a way that it was another kind of signal to people that, like, look, you know, this is what the book is going to be like, you know, that you're going to go down the stairs and then there's going to be this crazy thing.
Yeah.
And it was a good way to kind of prepare for the larger thing that happens later, or things even, you know, a lot of the book, like when I was going back and trying to make it more coherent later, you know, editing it and such, you know, a lot of it was kind of like a lot of sort of setup and of kind of, you know, warning the reader, you know, as it sort of got progressively weirder, you know, that, like, I wanted to sort of ease them into that, you know, so it's not like, you know, the underground city doesn't hit you all at once. There's this basement scene first, you know, that sort of gets you ready for the idea that, like, you know, they're going to go underground and crazy things happen there. And then, I mean, of course, part of it was that I had seen a cockfight and was really kind of blown away by it in many ways. Mm-hmm. And it was a good way to talk about that shock thing that I was talking about earlier, and at the same time make it very grounded in reality. I mean, that these things actually do happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I at one point spent some time making sure that occasionally the police do in fact break up cockfights in Washington Heights, because I wanted people to say, oh yeah, that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, but then when they're there, you start to unravel the strict reality of it.
You've alluded twice in this conversation to signals that you wanted to give to the reader, and I actually wanted to ask you, was this, I mean, when you were going back and trying to make the narrative more coherent, is this when the signals kind of became apparent?
Or? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is this definitely when the kind of narrative and the peaks and valleys kind of came into place?
Yeah, most definitely. I think I'm one of those people, and I think there are many people that do it this way, is that, you know, the first draft, you just go, and you don't think about it a lot, and you sort of go, okay, you know, we'll sort all this out later, and then, you know, when you...
We'll fix it in post.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a little callous, but it is a good way to kind of get the... You know, I'm one of those people where if I knew the ending to a thing when I was writing it, I would get bored. So then the writing would suffer, and then I would be in a hurry to finish it, and all that stuff would not work out. So I'm one of those people that really I need to be surprised as I'm writing it. You know, like I remember thinking there's a point where one of the characters says, I know where Manuel is, right? And I thought, I don't, you know? And I go, okay, so where is he? I have to answer that question now, because there it is in front of me. You know, he has to explain it, and... You know, I need to set that up for myself to keep you know, to keep my interest and to keep the writing at a level that I like.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean, the first draft was like a complete mess. I mean, it was really hard to follow and all of that sort of thing. And then I'm an editor for my day job.
Okay.
So, you know, I put it away for a couple of months, then took it out again, and then it's just the pure editor brain going like, okay, look, you know, this isn't working.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you get from here to here. And yeah, then that's when you really start pulling out, you know, the sort of the turns, you know, that show. Like, I really do think it's important that the reader be sort of guided through something. You know, whenever possible, you give them a signpost that, you know, it says, okay, you know, this is the kind of story it's going to be. You know, this is the sort of direction that this thing is going to go in. You know, you try to, you know, even from the first chapter, I mean, I did want it to be that the first page is kind of confusing and bewildering. So, you know, almost like it's like a billboard at that point. It's like, if you like this kind of thing, you're going to like this book. You know, if you don't like it, then don't, you know, don't read this, because this first page is what the rest of the book is like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that, like, I felt like that was really important to do, is to be honest about, you know, what I was trying to do.
Yeah. I'm curious also about the Church of Panic. Was this modeled on any specific religion, or?
No. Nothing, I wouldn't say, like, it's modeled on, you know, a specific cult or something like that. It's sort of, as you can see from the book, I mean, I am sort of interested in people that sometimes hold extreme ideas, and, you know, you know, cults are among them, you know, these people that have sort of weird ideas that they really believe, and they're very genuine about it, and, when I started, let me think about this for a minute, the first aspect of it is that that sort of plot point, you know, the idea that there's a cult out there that might actually have information, you know, that it's not faith, it's something that they actually know that nobody else knows, that was an idea that had been kicking around for years. And I think originally I felt like, you know, if I had written it 5 years earlier, it would have been a book about a cult. And then, you know, I realized later that was sort of a bad idea. But that whole idea, that little kernel of the idea, seemed to be a really, like, oh, this, you know, I can make something of this, and I just have to have it be part of something else. So, you know, that idea was kicking around. And then when the character Lucas showed up and I started to write about him and I liked him and I wanted, you know, I wanted a character who had sort of had, you know, everything he believed about the world to have been sort of demolished, and then, you know, he has to sort of rebuild himself from something, which is what a lot of the characters end up having to do. And it struck me that, you know, people who are deprogrammed from cults really experience the same kind of thing that, you know, that anybody does who has to completely re-alter their identity. You know, it's the, like, well, I used to be in this cult, and then the idea, there's a structure to the world and an order to it, and now that order is gone, and what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, and there are very, I don't think there are many people that want to live in the place where there's nothing, where there's no order at all. You know, they have to replace it with something.
Sure.
And I think that a lot of the book is about that, you know, that thing of, you know, what happens if the, you know, the order that you thought was the way the world worked turns out to not be the way the world works at all.
Yeah.
You know, now you have to find something else, but you can't really go back to being that innocent about it. You know, you know that whatever you're making is something that you've kind of created, you know?
Yeah.
And that I like that.
It can almost be applied to this book as well.
Yeah. And all of the characters, to some extent, go through that, you know, where they believe something and then that belief fades and they have to replace it with something else.
It's interesting because, I mean, in light of the ending, and I wish I could ask questions without revealing it, but, I mean, it's kind of that theme sort of... When did that come into place in terms of this... I wanted to kind of ask about the general climate of apocalyptic novels that is now in the air, and this...
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That's really bizarre, isn't it?
This could kind of... I mean, most of them are humorless, but yours, as well as Matthew Sharp's Jamestown, or perhaps
sitting on my shelf. I haven't read it yet.
Well, the thing is, and the similarity between those two books is that they both deal with these rather wild vernaculars. And I'm wondering, is this kind of how to contend with an apocalypse?
You're making me really want to. You're making me really want to bump that book up to the top of the pile.
Do you think there's something to that? That that apocalypse causes one to be sort of, I guess, hyper verbose in the way of trying to find the funny side of things? Or?
Gosh, I don't know. It has a. I almost wanted to flip that question on its head, because there's a part of me that, I am kind of, what's the right word for this? I think that books should be entertaining.
Yeah.
if they're fiction, I think they should be, like, from page to page, they should be entertaining in some way. Mm-hmm. And, there's a part of me that's really pessimistic, about many, many things. It doesn't surprise me that the book that came out of me is kind of apocalyptic. But on the other hand, I could not have written a book that was, like, relentlessly gloomy. Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't have, I wouldn't have enjoyed writing it. And, it's almost the other way around, where I find it weird that someone would write a serious book about apocalypse. Why be so serious about it? It's the apocalypse. You don't have to be any more serious. It's like,
well, perhaps because if you buy into this theory that all these apocalyptic novels come about from current events, then people must be very, very serious about
Maybe. I mean,
Well, how else can you sort of contend with it?
Right. You can't be more serious than the subject already is. So go in the other direction. Have a good time. I mean, it may help that, I mean, really, I had written it. This is kind of interesting to think about. So, I think what you're alluding to is the idea that people are more apocalyptic now that we live in the age of terror.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the supposed notion, that people have sort of put out theories, but no one's really sort of made any explicit connection. Because certainly there were lots of apocalyptic novels before all this.
Right. But it is interesting that there's a spate of them now.
Yeah.
I think that...
Perceived spate.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, what would be interesting to see is when these books were all actually written.
Yeah.
Certainly, like, some of them must have been, not written before 2001.
Sure.
And mine, ironically, is in that boat, though it wasn't, though earlier drafts of it were, 98 or 99. Like,
yeah.
I don't think it would have come out any differently had... had current events not intervened like that. I was just writing a book.
It's interesting to me that not only do you not want to play the 9/11 card in this book, but also in our conversation, you don't even want to utter the words.
Yeah. Well, part of it is that as an editor, I do a lot of public policy stuff.
Oh, okay.
And it's not a radical thing to say. I mean, you see it all the time in the news now, is that, the terrorist attacks changed the world in part because, our government decided that it wanted the world changed.
Yeah.
And, I didn't want to get into it, I guess. And you see when I'm editing something, it comes up because certainly the world has changed a great deal since 2001. But it's not... some of that is a result of people taking advantage of the situation. And, that's a really complex thing that you can't just throw out. It's not a card to play. It's something that you have to really talk about if you're going to talk about it.
Do you feel that card is played too frequently in fiction?
I don't know. I mean, I can't say that I read enough contemporary fiction to say whether it's played or not. I mean, certainly it's like, I haven't read Don DeLillo's recent book, which and I like him very much as an author, and he seems like a really great guy to take on that question, because he thinks very clearly, and he's unsentimental in ways that I really admire, that seems like a topic that I understand why he wrote that book, and it's great that he did. I mean, I imagine that I would really like the book. And at some point, I'm sure I'll read it. But um, I it is an easy card, right? I mean, as you know, it's because there is so much emotion attached to it, and now so much politics attached to it, you know, that it's an easy one to just throw out there, and much harder to really wrestle with it.
Oh, actually, to end this on a not so somber note.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oh no.
After I was saying how like happy, you know.
I know. No. There's plenty of happiness in this conversation, but I actually wanted to ask you just very quickly with one final question about the names in this book, which are very Pynchonian. I mean, you have two detectives.
Trout.
You have Wendell Apogee. Why names that kind of sparkle like that?
Well,
does it go back to the noun phrases?
No, part of it is very much from like. You know, the people that I was saying that I idolized, they're all those kind of like, you know, the sort of beat writers and the people that were, you know, that have the same sort of vibe as the beat writers.
Yeah.
All of whom give their characters really goofy names.
Yeah.
You know, like Burroughs does it. Pynchon, like, obviously does it a lot. Burroughs does it. Vonnegut does it. Even, like, Richard Brodigan does it. They all have these really crazy names. And I really love that. I mean, it's just as simple as that. Like, I think it's... And it's another good way to sort of show, like, look, you know, this book is not going to be completely serious. You know, there's these characters with these insane names, and, like, you know, if you want to take the characters seriously, it'll be because of something that they do, or, you know, because they're important to the plot. But, like, you know, let's keep in mind that this is all supposed to be kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another one of those just devices that I thought was really cool that all of those writers that I mentioned use. You know, it's a good way to kind of, you know, keep your sense of humor close at hand.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know, it's like let's not all start taking this all too seriously, okay?
Gotcha, it's a good guide. Well, Brian, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, likewise. Right, thanks a lot.
Thanks.